The next case on our calendar is 05-1530, Ohio State Bar Association versus Risa McCray. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm Ed Smith, attorney from Dayton, Ohio. I'm here with Gene Wetzel, general counsel of the Ohio State Bar Association. Mr. Hugh Wall was unable to make the argument because of medical reasons and asked to be excused. I would request the court to reserve 3 minutes rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
Your Honors, we're here on a disciplinary matter resulting from objections we filed to the final report of the Board of Commissioners on grievances and discipline in the case of Risa C. McCray from Dayton. The objections revolve around a divorce case involving one Michael Beam, and the board found that there was a violation of DR 9102A2, preserving the identity of funds and property of a client relating to $5,500 in various payments of retainer fees that the last payment ended on, I think, in February of 01. And those fees were deposited in the trust or in the operating account of Ms. McCray rather than the trust account. During the course of the proceedings, there was a sale of the marital residence, and the court ordered, trial court ordered that $5,200 each be placed in an escrow fund by each of the attorneys. Ms. McCray deposited $5,200 into her trust account during the course of the proceedings.
Counsel, did Mr. Beam testify at the hearing?
No, Your Honor. There were no live witnesses at the hearing.
There's a finding that the monies that represented the sale of the house that she put into her trust account and then withdrew without court approval, that he had a verbal agreement that she was entitled to those as fees. Is that in dispute at all?
Your Honor, we contend that he may have led her to believe that. I think in our findings we said that there was an appearance that he led her to believe that, but that not that it was agreed to specifically.
So you dispute that they had an agreement, but that she had
That's
a
That's correct. That she alleges that there was an agreement.
And did anybody present any evidence that there wasn't an agreement? If he didn't testify, how would you refute her?
No, we didn't. Nobody.
What's the basis of your belief that he only led her to think that?
I wasn't at his deposition, but I believe he stated in his deposition words that led to the effect that he expected that money to be there at the end for the use of paying the attorney fees.
So her belief that she had an agreement was a reasonable belief, if that's his testimony.
Possibly, but we contend that because of the court order.
I understand that argument. That's a separate argument entirely. I mean, I think we'd have a different argument if he never said she could use those for fees. She didn't have a court order, and then she's sort of self-dealt. I think we have a different issue if the expectation was that those were to be for attorney fees. Then we're really only limited to we don't have like a theft issue. We're limited to a violation of court order, and that's what you're contending. She violated a court order.
Yes, Your Honor. We're contending that. We're contending at the time in December of 01 when she transferred those funds to herself that she wasn't entitled to them at that point.
Does anybody dispute that she was entitled to attorney fees in that amount eventually, no matter how she paid herself?
She had not billed for those fees until shortly before that when another attorney took over. She sent a bill for 136 hours of time that she reconstructed. That's why we put in the stipulation that she did make a best efforts after the fact. But she was aware that she was not allowed to take that money because conceivably the court could have ordered that that money go to Mrs. Beam rather than Mr. Beam.
Counsel, in fact, didn't she falsify the dates on which she actually removed the money from the account? Did she initially that she did it post-order from the court, and in reality it was before the order from the court?
Yes, Your Honor, she represented to Mr. Miller, the investigator, that she had taken this money after the final decree went on, rather than beforehand. She claimed in her deposition that, which is, has been filed with the court, that she had personal problems. She was had been on the bench shortly when this was going on, and her family had some illnesses, and so there were some mitigating factors that might have made it difficult to prove that she did that intentionally. But that was correct, Your Honor. She did represent that she had taken the money after the decree went on, when in fact she did it before. And to this day, there's still $200 in her trust account that she hasn't dispersed to the client. So we think that she should be found to have violated a court order and also engaged in conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice. And the court has several cases that it's decided, the Witt case recently in 2004, that's almost on point. And we're going beyond those, not only those merit claims, but also the recommended sanction, and saying that that was too light, that in these kind of cases, the court normally gives a suspension, even if it stayed. In the Witt case, this was a criminal lawyer who was used to depositing criminal fees into his operating account. And on a civil case, he deposited fees into his operating account. The court gave a six-month stayed suspension in that case. And in the Maybaum case in 2003, almost on all fours, that was a six-month stayed suspension. The same thing, the client sent money to replenish the retainer fees, and in that case, the lawyer went further. He actually billed for the time. In this case, Mr. Beam never received a bill until after he had discharged the client, and she represented at that time that she had already applied the fee.
Mr. Smith, let me ask you, back to the Witt case, if it is found, as Mr. Hollingsworth argues, that Mr. Beam, the client, did authorize the lawyer, Ms. McCray, to use the funds or apply the funds in the trust account to her fees that she was owed, does Witt control? Or there we said there was a blatant commingling of funds, or at least there was no question there was a commingling of funds there. Here there seems to be some issue over that, and I'll ask Mr. Hollingsworth when he's arguing.
Your Honor, I don't believe that a client, that's why we're here. Are we going to allow a client to authorize the attorney to violate a court order?
Well,
now, this isn't just a discovery order.
That's a separate issue, but the other issue is whether these funds were the equivalent of attorney's fees. And there seems to be some, Mr. Hollingsworth argues a couple of places, that Mr. Beam did authorize the funds to be used as attorney's fees. At least that's the way I read the brief.
That's correct, but that's a disputed fact. He didn't have authority. Even if he did that, he didn't have authority to do that.
Let's assume there was no court order, and the finding is that the facts indicate that the client has authorized the lawyer to apply the trust account funds to the lawyer's fee. Is there a problem? Let's assume there's a deposition and that it is not even contested.
Your Honor, I'd have trouble with the court allowing that to go forward with a and say that that's okay to violate that court order, especially with Ms.
Well, the example I gave you was no court order.
Okay, no court order.
No court order. Just funds, client's funds in a trust account, and the client at some point says it's okay to apply. You don't have to make a check out to me of my trust, essentially the funds that are being held by the lawyer in trust. You just apply them to your fee. Is that
as long as those funds are earned, that would be acceptable. The preferable thing to do would have that in writing first.
Right.
But those fees would have to be earned, and how would you be able to tell if they've been earned until you've rendered a bill? And she never kept her time until after the fact. She knew that she couldn't do this, Your Honors. Exhibit B to the complaint, which has been admitted in the answer, said you must pay my attorney's fees from another source so that I am not at risk of being in contempt for transferring the funds or release the funds to me by signing a document and replacing the funds by paying $1,750 per month until the next hearing. So she was almost inviting a violation there in and of itself. And she knew, based on that letter, that she couldn't take those funds out, even with his consent. So, Your Honors, we believe that the sanction should be more severe, and also that the court should find that there were violations of conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, and also violating a rule of court. Again, not just a routine, so to speak, discovery rule or anything like that, but a specific rule regarding funds that weren't even determined at that point to be the property of Mr. Beam.
Counsel, there's some reference in the opinion or from the board that inadvertence seems to be a finding for the commingling of funds and for the deposit of clients' monies into an operating account as opposed to a trust account. What is the basis for the inadvertence excuse?
Your Honor, that's why we're here. We have no finding of the board as to why it was inadvertent, other than the fact that maybe he expected that money to be there for the payment of attorney's fees eventually. The board did not find that the $5,500 was inadvertent. That wasn't inadvertent. It's just the escrowed funds that they found was inadvertent. And we're saying, no, it wasn't. She knew from this letter that she couldn't do that. And so it's mystifying to us how the panel and the board could find that this was inadvertent.
Counsel, you're recommending a stayed suspension, not actual timeout. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What is the recommendation precisely?
For a six-month stayed suspension.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Hollingsworth.
Good morning, Your Honors. First off, I'd like to apologize for the fact that my client's not present. As has been the case for several years, she's been caring for an ailing father and therefore couldn't make it, although I'd hope she would. I'd like to begin by stating that I think this court knows that the disciplinary rules presuppose that disciplinary assessment of a lawyer's conduct will be made on the basis of the facts and circumstances as they existed at the time of the conduct in question. Also, the disciplinary rule presupposes that whether or not discipline should be imposed for a violation, and in particular the severity of the sanction, depends on the circumstances. In this particular case, there have been some questions about the manner in which this particular client managed the funds that came to her from the client she represented at the time. I am not here to tell you that the better practice wouldn't have been to provide timely billing I'm not here to tell you that the better practice wouldn't have been to go back to the trial court in the matter and to get leave of court in order to remove those funds and apply them toward the payment of fees. What I am here to talk about are the facts and circumstances that I believe the panel and the Board of Commissioners took into consideration in reaching the determination that, yes, there was a violation of 9102 with respect to the management of the funds, but otherwise no other disciplinary violations. The part of the problem with the case is the record, and part of the problem with the record is that it is before you based primarily upon stipulations and the arguments of counsel at the time of the hearing. We can get into matters relating to what evidence would have been presented if the matter had gone forward, but I think it's important to point to at least a couple of things in the record. First, as it relates to the stipulations, paragraph number 14 clearly indicates that on June 13, 2001, approximately 5 months before Mr. Beam terminated Ms. McCrae's services, that Mr. Beam was notified that he had an outstanding balance on his account of fees and expenses in excess of $5,700. The monies that formed the basis of the complaint that the attorney inappropriately moved funds out of the trust account without prior court authorization relate to the payment of that $5,700 bill. So there is no evidence to contradict the fact that the client was not on notice that he owed money. There is also part of the stipulation of the fact that the client indicated to the attorney that the $5,200 that was being retained as part of the court-ordered escrowed funds would be there to pay for the attorney's fees and services at some point. Now, the question of whether or not there was commingling of funds is an interesting question in that if the panel had taken evidence, what the panel would have heard is that the attorney involved had approximately 31 years of experience in the practice, had primarily a criminal and bankruptcy practice, some domestic relations practice, and her practice was one of which she billed on a flat fee basis. She would say, it's going to take X dollars to do this work, and generally speaking, that's what the clients would pay. She'd do the work. In this particular case, the fee agreement clearly indicates that she was going to charge X dollars for out-of-court work and X dollars for in-court work. She requested a retainer. She received the retainer. She put the retainer in an operating account. The relator argues that somehow that's the commingling of funds. Yes, she put funds into the operating account before they were earned. But what is missing from this record is any indication that the fees were never earned, because, in fact, they were. If the fees had never been earned, they would have been challenged. Yes, she produced a fee agreement at or near the time of her termination, and that fee agreement clearly outlined the work that she had done during the
Counsel, I don't think that, at least in my mind, I have no problem with the fact that she eventually earned this money and may even have earned the entire sum. I'm concerned about the proof that she had knowledge that she was not to touch this money absent a court order. She was a longtime domestic relations practitioner, and everyone knows the twists and turns that a domestic relations case can take, and the predicting of what an order would be, that there would be that money left over at the end of the proceedings to pay her fee, was a huge presumption. And the fact that she knew she was not to take it, and she was dishonest with the investigator as to the timing of the removal. Those are the problems I have with your client.
Okay. Well, let me deal first with the question of dishonesty. That question goes to the question of cooperation during the investigation. Yes, there's no doubt about it that at the time she was initially contacted, she advised the investigator that she believed that the funds had been removed from the account after the order went on. She was wrong. And I discovered that she was wrong after I was retained during the course of the investigation, and I communicated such to the investigator. So the grievance committee was not misled. The grievance committee was not put in a position where somehow it had to go off on some tangent to conduct some discovery. I corrected the error as her agent because I recognized upon reviewing the files and the account that that was a mistake. And the reason that I've been given and we've shared with the investigator is that she was doing a lot of things. She was on the bench as an interim appointee. She was running for office. She had issues with her father's health in Pennsylvania, and so she was distracted. Clearly, she said something that was an error. I'm not here to apologize for it. What I am here to say is that as her agent during the course of the investigation, I corrected the mistake. There was nothing said beyond what I said to correct the mistake that caused anybody else to be misled. There was no intent to mislead the investigation. And even if you assume that her initial statement was, it was corrected by me, and nothing happened beyond that that caused any problems with the investigation. Now, there are two issues here, but I want to deal secondly with the one about the escrowed funds. The court order from March of 2001 clearly indicated that the $10,500 in equity coming from the sale of the marital residence would be divided between the two parties, the husband and the wife. My client represented the husband. She was clearly under a court order to put those funds into an escrow account and to leave them there until subsequent order of the court. That's essentially what the order says. Those funds were placed into the account in June of 2001. Those funds were removed from the account in December of 2001. The final decree went on in March of 2002. I submit that it was known to everybody that the funds belonged to the client. The question of whether or not they would ultimately end up in the client's possession clearly was in the discretion of the court. Court had to decide what the real facts are, which party may have owed funds to the other, and determine if that were the case. Ultimately, the court decided that the escrowed funds held by my client did, in fact, belong to her client. Ultimately, that happened. There's no doubt about it. The better practice and the better course of action would have been to obtain consent from the court with respect to the application of those funds before it happened. No question about that. It didn't happen here. And the good thing is nobody ended up being harmed in the sense that the court would have ordered the funds to go someplace else. I concede that. I'm not arguing that. I'm not saying that it was the right thing to do. I'm saying it was not the correct thing to do because it wasn't the correct practice that you want to advocate. However, as I've argued in my brief, I think there are other ways in which that issue could have been addressed well short of a disciplinary proceeding. I think the trial court could have easily dealt with the matter by way of some contempt proceeding. If, in fact, the attorney who replaced her in November of 2001 had to know that the funds were in the trust account, presumably by reviewing the file or having a conversation with his client. He didn't seek any support from the court, didn't file any motions to have the funds transferred from her account to his account. The client clearly knew that the funds were in the escrow account. He apparently didn't tell the lawyer or told the lawyer, and both decided to do nothing about moving the funds. In my opinion, if in fact the client and the subsequent attorney felt that the funds were not to be applied to the fees, then they should have gone to the trial court and sought the assistance of the court to get the funds back. Nothing like that's happened. Nothing happened like that, which suggests that my client's statement about her client at the time, the husband, saying the funds will be used to pay for your fees is consistent with her understanding and her communications with him. I grant you that it was not good practice.
Counsel, the bar, if I understand their argument, is, and maybe I misstate this, but I think they object even more strongly to the failure to find violation of DR 102A5, engaging in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. They're bothered more by that than the public reprimand. Could you address that? I mean, they do suggest a sanction higher than what the board imposed, but I think they find most troubling the failure to find a violation.
First off, the question of whether or not it's misconduct goes to the intent of the client here, and I don't think this client had any intent of trying to violate the court order. Granted, she didn't do the right thing, at least not from my perspective, but I don't think there was any intent here to violate the court order. I think she had in her mind a belief that these funds belonged to her client, who told her to apply those funds toward the payment of fees and expenses. She did so. Would the wiser course of action have been to wait until after the final decree was issued? Yes. It didn't happen that way. The question of adversely affecting the administration of justice goes to the question of what happened here. And in this particular case, the court ultimately decided that the client who instructed the attorney to apply the fees did, in fact, own the funds.
Well, the panel did make a very specific finding here. It says the panel, page 3 of their report, the panel believes that it is not every violation of a court order that amounts to conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice.
And I believe that to be true. I've spent a considerable amount of time in our brief addressing that issue. There are a number of orders that might be issued by the trial court going to scheduling matters that if, for example, the attorney fails to comply with, could by definition be conduct adverse to the administration of justice because it may delay the case in some way. But is that really the way you want to apply this rule? I submit the answer is not. I think that would be bad policy because such a rule would then essentially say that every time I fail to meet the requirements of the court order, a deadline, at that point I am potentially in violation of DR 1-102A5, and I don't think that's what we want. I don't think this court wants to be inundated with disciplinary complaints that deal with matters that can be better addressed by the trial court through the management of that particular court in the way of some form of contempt. If there are no further questions, I'm through, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollingsworth. Mr. Smith, you've saved a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. You're correct, Mr. Justice Pfeiffer, that we are bothered more by the failure to find the violation than we are by the sanction. It's interesting in the stipulations, it says the respondent maintains that Mr. Beam advised respondent she could pay his unpaid fees and expenses from the escrowed funds. And then in the findings of the board specifically found at the bottom of page 2, the top of page 3, regarding the testimony regarding the expectation of Mr. Beam, and they stated the client never specifically directed or invited respondent to remove the money contained in the escrow account. The implication of his testimony was that he expected ultimately to pay the remaining fees out of the money left in escrow from the sale of the house. And it is true, as Justice O'Connor has pointed out, in divorce cases, the main fight is over the money. Whose money is it? Is it the husband's or is it the wife's? And so to just go ahead and say, to use self-help, in violation of your oath of office to follow the law really prejudices the administration of justice. And therefore, we think that the court should make those findings and use the sanction that's appropriate, which is a suspension, a state suspension at least. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.